The scripture reading tonight is taken from Esther, the 7th chapter, the first 8 verses. I'll be reading from the English Standard Version tonight. So the king and Haman went to the feast with Queen Esther. And on the second day, as they were drinking wine after the feast, the king again said to Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to the half of my kingdom it shall be fulfilled." Then Queen Esther answered, "If I found favor in your sight, O king, let it please the king, and let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, and I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. If it had not been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been solid, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king." Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who has dared to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman." And then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. And the king rose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went to the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned after the palace garden to the place where they were being drinking wine, as Haman had fallen on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house?" And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face.
The title for tonight's lesson is Esther's Exposure. And Esther, whenever she is presenting herself, as we see in the scripture reading here just a moment ago, is really exposing a lot. She's, of course, exposing the plot that Haman has against the Jewish people. But as she points out to the king, it's also against her. In that, she's exposing Haman's deception by lies of omission that he's made to the king concerning these people. Also, it's an exposure, though, of herself. Because you remember, up to this point, King Ahasuerus has no idea that his wife is actually a Jew. Nor does he know the case with Mordecai and all of the other things. So what Esther does in this is, by exposing herself and who she is, she puts herself in mortal danger. Not only by the fact that she is expressing to the king that she's the subject to die under this law, and perhaps the king could be upset with her, but also the fact that before all of this took place, before the feast has taken place that Brother Maurice read for us just a moment ago, whenever she approached the king, she put herself at risk. She was exposing herself to danger there because she was breaking the law, because she had not been requested by the king to come before his presence. And if he was not of a mind to receive her, she would then be immediately taken away and put to death. So there's a big risk that she's taking in all of this. And I don't believe that that can be lost on us. We can never fully appreciate the magnitude of this story if we do not start to grasp just how much danger she put herself in personally for the cause of her people. So she leaves for us really a great example. Now this morning we talked about Mordecai and the courage that Mordecai had, and looking at the position that God had placed him, all the way back to the fact that his family was some of those that were exiled into Babylon. His family also was some of those that remained after the Jews started to go back to Jerusalem, right, under the Medo-Persian reign, under King Cyrus. Not all the Jews went back. Some of the Jews did remain there in Babylon under Persian rule. It seems that Daniel was one of them too. So there were still some people that remained. And so there's that aspect. There's the aspect also that Mordecai found himself in a place that he could have some connection to the royal court. He also raised up Hadatha or Esther, because she was an orphan. And then he has an opportunity to present her before the king, and the king chooses her as his queen. And then he's able then to have connection to the king through Esther, and he uses it though for good. For instance, undercovering the plot of assassination against the king that was written down in the records, as we read about this morning. And Mordecai is the one who's able then to go to Esther, as we read this morning, and he is able to present to Esther the truth of the situation, that they are all in danger of dying, and that Esther must go and present herself before the king, because if she does not, then the fate of her and all the people is already set. They will all be murdered, massacred. It's genocide. And Mordecai utters those very famous words, like we read this morning, and this was in chapter 4 of Esther, and at the end of verse 14. And again, to me, this is a pivotal verse in the whole book, where he says, "And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Esther, who's to know that this isn't what God has planned for all along? That you would be placed in this position so that you might save his people. Even going back to the fact, that even harkens back to the fact, why was Esther chosen to begin with? Well, she was a strikingly beautiful woman. That's what was particularly notable about her. This is part of what Ahasuerus noted about her as well. And that perhaps this is why God made her beautiful, so that she would then again be chosen and placed in this position. As we mentioned briefly this morning, part of what makes this book, I think, particularly wonderful is the fact that God is not ever explicitly brought out in the story, in the whole book. I mean, you never see God show up on the scene to fix things. Like you see, for instance, the Exodus, right? Where he comes and he destroys the Egyptian army. But that doesn't mean that God's not present in the lives of these people. He very much is. And Mordecai is able to see that and sense it. But, as with the providence of God, Mordecai is not able to just put his thumb on it, for sure. He says, for who knows? It's a lot like what Paul says later when he's writing to Philemon. Perhaps this is why all of this took place. Which to me is assuring to us, and letting us know that these great heroes of faith did not know any more than we did at times. In fact, we could argue that they actually knew less because they didn't have all the scriptures preserved for them. They didn't have the stories to go back like we did. They only had a small portion. So that's part of what is particularly, I think, beautiful and encouraging in Esther, is how you see God work through the lives of these people, the providence of God take place in history for him to take care of his people as he has promised. It's a good lesson for us, and it's very encouraging to us. Right? Part of what makes Esther also such a wonderful book, and I was talking to some of you this morning about this, and you were telling me how it's one of your favorite books, if not your favorite book, it's because, I mean, it's, as far as Bible stories go, I mean, it's got it all. It's a great drama. It's a great movie. In fact, they've made movies out of Esther. I mean, specifically, it is Esther, called Esther and all of that, but even storylines that are based off of, and it's great. It's got all kinds of drama, and it's full of irony. To the fact that you have Mordecai's exaltation, right? We'll talk about in just a moment. And then you have Haman's execution. You have the Jews' vindication. And then you have the Feast of Purim or the Feast of Lots at the end. All irony. Very fitting irony, right? So it's a beautiful book. It's a wonderful book, and it's enjoyable to read. You see justice take place in it. Again, with the providence of God working behind the scenes, so it's never explicitly mentioned. Now, as we mentioned this morning, Haman is one of the characters, and Brother Maurice mentioned Haman here. Haman plays a central role in all of this because Haman rises up to be basically second in command over the whole kingdom of Persia. And Haman is a horribly wicked person. He's a bad person. He's very rich. He's very powerful. He's very cunning. He's very shrewd. Again, he's very wicked. He's very prideful. He's very arrogant. What sets it all off, as we mentioned this morning, is the fact that Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman. We gave our speculations on that this morning, why Mordecai refused that. But because of this, Haman decides he's not only going to kill Mordecai, but he's going to kill all the Jews. And as we mentioned this morning, the way that he goes about this is that he deceives the king, convinces the king with painting the Jews in a picture of they're just a bunch of lawbreakers, and we just need to get rid of them. And he says, I will actually pay for this. I will give you a donation for this if you'll let me just take care of it for you. And the king signs the law. He stamps it with his ring, his seal, right, and puts it into effect, right? Haman, in deciding when the Jews are actually going to be killed, that's where he casts lots to decide, well, when am I going to kill these people? Well, he casts lots, right? So it's a roll of the dice, basically, of when he's going to do it. The lot falls where it is, and he decides when he's going to kill them, right? Mordecai perceives this. The Jews finally perceive this. Esther gets word from Mordecai about all of this, and it's sackcloth and ashes. And they're mourning and they're weeping, right? As we looked this morning, and we mentioned just a moment ago, whenever Mordecai finally is able to go to Esther and get the message to her of what she needs to do, at least what his assessment is, and she, of course, retorts with the danger that she's going to be put in, and Mordecai says, Esther, for such a time as this, perhaps, we see that Esther's response to Mordecai then is that she will do what he's requested. Now, this morning we talked about how, you know, what part do we play in God's scheme of redemption? I mean, his plan and his kingdom. I mean, God's plan is not done. If it was done, I mean, this whole world would be burned up at this point. Things are not finished yet. History is still being written, right, as far as God's kingdom and God's people right now. Are you a Mordecai? That was part of the question this morning. You may have your own Mordecai moment in God's kingdom of being the one who is able to stand up and be the wise one to observe what's going on and the trajectory of things and be able to encourage those who are in a position to actually do something to do just that and have the bravery. Perhaps it's an individual that you can help encourage. Perhaps it's a whole generation of people. I don't know. It may be something local and something small, maybe on a bigger scale too. I don't know. But that's the thing. We're always watchful, like Mordecai. And we talked about Esther this morning too. We're going to talk a little bit about her in just a moment. Maybe it's your Esther moment. But I want to mention this. Because what does Esther say here? Esther then goes on and says, you know, go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf. And do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women also will fast as you do. When I go to the king, though it is against the law, if I perish, I perish. That line right there is another powerful line. If I die, I die. Reminds me of, we mentioned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego this morning, or Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They have the same sort of attitude. You remember King Nebuchadnezzar, whenever he is going to throw them in the fiery furnace, and they declare, the God that we serve can deliver us, and we believe he will, but however, O king, if he chooses not to, know that we will not bow. If we die, we die. And that's Esther's attitude, and we have to have that willingness too. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die serving the Lord faithfully and doing what everything I can, giving myself wholly to God's people and God's kingdom. And it may be that you very well may be an Esther, or you may have an Esther moment in your life, again, within your family, within your congregation, within your community. I don't know. Now, will any of us be an Esther on like a national stage, like we see here, and you know, or like Mordecai? Probably not. Doesn't mean that we won't, but probably not. But that doesn't mean we don't have a part to play. Because look at you, what did Esther say here? What did she want from Mordecai? Tell the people to do what? All the people, all the Jews everywhere, send word out to do what? Fast and pray for me. Does fasting and prayer work? Yes, it does. Does God hear? Yes. Does he see? Yes, he does. And we are told explicitly in the book of James that the prayer of a righteous man availeth much. And this very well may be the part that we play, all of us. This is something that we can all do continually for God's kingdom, is pray. Fast and pray. What is that about? It's about showing humility before God, pleading before God, setting aside some of the luxuries of life for a time so that we can focus on what really matters. And it may be, my friends, that that's what each and every one of us will be called to do. Fast and pray. Certainly it's something that we should be praying continually. Right? That may be the part that we play. Is it any less than the others? No, it's not. It's not. Certainly not. So who are you? Are you a Mordecai? Are you an Esther? Are you the people? Are you a mix of all? I don't know. That's for you to discover in your life and what God has planned for you, my friends. But we can all gain some encouragement from what we see here in the book of Esther in desperate times. Now, as we go on, we get then to Esther preparing the banquet now. Esther, whenever she prepares this banquet she has for the king, she explicitly tells the king, I want you to come to this and I want you to bring along Haman. As well. Nothing completely unusual about that. I mean, Haman, again, is second in command. We kind of talked this morning about, like, with our own government, you know, like, inviting the president and the vice president or something like that, right? But Haman, whenever he gets the word of this, what do you think he believes? He thinks this is a great honor. I mean, not only is he going to be able to go and sup with the king, but it's at the queen's invitation. The beautiful queen has wanted him to come. And she's going to prepare the feast for him. So surely there is going to be some great honor bestowed for him. In fact, it goes on to say that after the request has been made in verse 9 of Esther chapter 5, it says, Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. I mean, he's on cloud 9 about this. This is great. Life's good for him. And it's going to get just better, he thinks. Of course, it's at that moment that the text goes on to say that he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, and he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. And he sent and brought his friends and his wife, Zeresh. And Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and of the servants of the king. And Haman said, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. You know, this is, like what he says, worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. This is where worldliness gets you. Haman is a completely worldly person. I mean, he's materialistic, he's all about power, he's all about wealth, he's all about influence, right? And if he can't have it all, he's not happy. Well, you're never going to be able to have it all in this life. You see, There's no joy in this. He's going to get even with Mordecai. So his wife Zeresh, right, and all his friends sitting there. Again, he's married to a dandy here. Makes you think of Jezebel. Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. And the idea pleased Haman. And he had the gallows made. Makes me think of what Proverbs talks about when we're running along with those who hasten to the shedding of blood of the innocent, right? He warns against going along with people like that, right? Evil companions corrupt good morals, right? Is what Paul said in Corinthians. Teaches us a lot here too. And so, of course, as we go on, we see it's actually that night that the king can't sleep. And remember, we mentioned a moment ago, right, and we mentioned this morning, that there was something written in the chronicles of the king, or the records of the king, that becomes important later on. Well, so the king can't sleep, so what does he do? He gives orders to bring the book of the memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they're to be read before the king. Now, I find this interesting. I mean, was he doing this because, you know, I want to get caught up on everything, or is it kind of like really dry reading, and I'm wanting to read something that will put me to sleep, you know? Maybe a little bit of both, you know. Maybe a little bit of both. You want to read some legalese, right, and all of that. So he's having it read to him, but there's something that catches his ear. So reading about how a plot was against the king, an assassination plot, and there was one who thwarted this plot. And the king says, wait. I need to hear more about that. Go back. And so he has it read to him again, and he wants to know who is, and it's Mordecai. Remember we talked about that. Mordecai is the one who thwarted the assassination plot against the king. And the king says, well, have we honored Mordecai for this? Well, no. Sorry, we haven't. Well, we should do this, right? Why not? We absolutely need to be honoring this man, right? And so, the king then says, well, who's in the court right now, right? Who's in the palace and everything, right? I mean, so we can get him over here. Well, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king says, well, let him come in. Bring him in, right? Bring him in. And so Haman comes in. The king says to him immediately, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? What can I do for someone that I really want to honor, Haman? And Haman, being the humble man he is, that's why, right? You're so vain, you might think this song is about you, comes to mind, right? I mean, he can't help but think, oh, this is about me. And so he says, well, I mean, if you're going to really honor somebody, king, let me tell you what you need to do. First, you need to get some royal robes be brought, right, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, you know, a nice noble steed, a royal from the royal herd. I mean, needs to be brought, right, and on whose head the royal crown, right, is to be set, that the robes and the horses be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, even, right, to then lead the horse around, right, through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. This sounds good to the king. He's like, Haman, you know, you were the right guy to ask for this. I knew you'd have the best idea. I want you to do just that. Go, take the robes, take the horse, just as you've said, and I want you to go, and I want you to get Mordecai, put the robes on him, put him on the horse. And you are the most noble official I have. I want you to lead that horse around the square of the city and proclaim everybody just how great Mordecai is. Again, you remember, he was coming to the king to talk about what? The gallows that he just built for this guy. You see? And so, of course, Haman is forced to do this. The thing that Haman wants so desperately, not only does he not get it, but he's forced to give it to the guy that he despises with a vengeance, right? Does our God have a sense of humor? Oh, you better believe he does. You better believe he does, right? So Haman, of course, this makes Haman even more incensed with rage, right? And he is going to destroy Mordecai, and he is going to destroy the Jewish people with much more satisfaction, right, than he ever had before. However, we see that, once again, Esther reveals the plot. And this is where the scripture reading picks up. So Esther has, when she has the banquet, she doesn't just have one banquet, right? She actually invites the king back to multiple banquets, right? Before she delivers the news. Perhaps to give some time, perhaps to let him, get used to, maybe soften up a little bit. I mean, it has been a month since she's talked to him. I don't know, but maybe this is part of the custom of the land, too. I've read different ideas on why she didn't do it immediately. Okay. Wouldn't do it like the first. Kind of like in the South, you're going to go talk to somebody and make a request of them. You don't just show up or get them on the phone and say, hey, can you do... You have to shoot the breeze for a little while, right? 20 minutes into the conversation, then you can ease into the request that you have, right? You don't just come out and say it. So maybe that's what's going on, a bit of custom. Again, I've read different opinions on it. Either way, though, I don't need to go back and read it for you, but as Brother Maurice had already read it for us, but it's that particular banquet that she reveals that not only are her people being put in danger, but she's being put in danger as well. She's going to be killed, and the king, of course, is incensed by this. And he says, well, who is it? Well, it's none other than Haman. And the plot is exposed, the plot is revealed. The king steps out, he's in a rage. Haman then comes before the queen, clamoring at her, saying, begging for mercy. And the king steps in and sees Haman clamoring at the queen. Are you going to abuse the queen here right before me? And so he has him taken out immediately. And what is his fate? Irony of ironies, right? He's hung on the gallows that he prepared for Haman, right? Ironic justice, right? Very fitting. When you go through the scriptures, I think you see this pattern of how God is able to take the weapon of the enemy and actually turn it around on him, right? We even see this, I believe, with the sacrifice of Jesus, right? The way that trying to destroy the Son of Man, the Son of God, through the crucifixion actually is the path or the avenue through which God is going to save all of mankind. And death is destroyed. It's wonderful. It's wonderful how God does this. And God will do this for us in the end too. Rest assured. Be faithful to the Lord. Cling to Him. And all will be well in a little while. Though it may seem like a long time to us. In His time, right? But here's where it goes on. It's not only then that Haman now is killed. This law is still in effect, and the date's set, and Haman's already put the plan in motion, right? Because he sent his squadron out to go and to destroy the Jews. So even though Haman's dead, there's still a problem to deal with. And so Esther pleads with the king to change this law and to try to reverse the effects of this. And so the king does that. The king reverses the law, and he stamps it into order that it can never be reversed now. And now, what has he done? He's gone out, and he has given the Jews the right to defend themselves against those that are coming after him, right? Makes me think of the Philistines. You remember what the Philistines did to the Jewish people? They made it illegal for there to be blacksmiths, right, in the land. At least a Jewish blacksmith. You remember why? So they couldn't forge weapons, okay? They made all the Jews give up their weapons, and then they all made it illegal not only to have weapons, but then they made it illegal for them to be able to make their own weapons, right? So in order for them to get their farming implements sharpened and forged and all that, they had to then pay, right, those that were controlling them, the Philistines, to sharpen their farm implements and forge their farm implements, which then they used to farm, and the majority of those crops went to whom? The Philistines. You see, we see a pattern here. Not only in Scripture, you see a pattern throughout history. You see a pattern even in our own country. What? Okay? The devil and his minions have used the same sort of patterns over and over again. It's the same thing here. The Jews, though, are given permission to then defend themselves. And so then in chapter 9, what we read about is them doing just that. Let's just read a little bit of this, okay? Read just a little bit of this, where it says, "Now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm. And no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all the peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and, satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house." And they knew it. Remember, he'd been honored already. The honoring of Mordecai isn't just an isolated event that happens in a vacuum either. And it's just like, okay, well, Mordecai got his day and we move on. No, because of that, Mordecai now is elevated to a higher position. And his name and his fame goes throughout the land. And so you see the effects of it here. It's amazing. You see how all of this is working together, right? The hindsight is 20/20, right? "For Mordecai was great in the king's house, and his fame spread throughout all the provinces. For the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. In Susa, the citadel itself, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men and also killed..." And then we go on and he gives a whole list of different names of people and such that don't mean much to us because they're not in our time anymore, but it takes a bit of study to go back. And I'll tell you, I haven't studied all their names and know who they all are in history. But what we have, again, is the irony of the ironies here. Those who would have killed the Jews now are the ones who are killed by the Jews. Look at this. I'll just read this few verses to you. Verse 16. "Now the rest of the Jews who were in the king's province has also gathered to defend their lives and got relief from their enemies and killed 75,000 of those who had hated them. But they laid no hands on the plunder." So you see the Jews' conduct. They are not the people that Haman had painted before the king. That these were wicked people that didn't obey the laws of the land and all of this, and they need to be put away and all of that. We see honor here. They defended themselves because the king told them to defend themselves, but they didn't touch the plunder. Didn't ransack or anything. Again, a point to their character. What are the names of those, all these Jews that were involved in this? Don't know. We don't know. But you know who knows? God knows. God knows your name when you're in his army, when you're his king, in his kingdom, part of his body. We have our part to play. What is our part? We don't always know. It's often thrust upon us. But my friends, we need to have the foresight and the wisdom like Mordecai. And being willing and ready to stand up and see things for what they are. And to be able to embolden and encourage those who can do something. We need to be like Esther if the lot falls before us and on us. That we need to be the ones to lay ourselves on the line. Again, we cannot overestimate just how much she put at risk for this. We mentioned this briefly this morning, but she had a life of luxury. And she could have tried to fly under the radar and think that, okay, it'll be fine for me, I'll get through this. Mordecai, of course, tells her differently. But again, as we mentioned this morning, I mean, how many of us, we just want to be left alone. I don't want to stir up trouble. I don't want to be involved. I just want to go about my quiet, peaceful life. Yes. But it may be that we can't have it for the time. Again, remember where our rest really lies. It lies in heaven, not here. Here we're about the Lord's business and about the Lord's work. We need to be strong and courageous in that work. And that's never an easy thing. And it is always a sacrificial thing. And it is always, in many ways, a scary thing. We cannot be deceived into thinking that there was not some fear for Esther, at least initially. But that's what true courage is. It doesn't take courage, right, to take that step or that leap of faith and there not be some risk involved, personal risk. She had true courage. And it's a great example to us. What we then have, and here's the last irony, is that we then have this feast that is set in order, right? And it's called the Feast of Purim. We read about it at the very end here in Esther chapter 9, beginning in verse 20. And we read about it some more throughout the end there. What is the Feast of Purim? It's also known as the Feast of Lots. Why is it called the Feast of Lots? Well, we're told in the Feast of Lots because of Haman, the Agite, and how he had decided that he was going to, on what day he was going to kill these Jews. Remember, what was it? It was a casting of lots, a roll of the dice again. And so, irony of ironies, then now, this time that was meant to be, through the casting of lots, right, this time of the Jews' genocide, rather now is a time of celebration, the vindication of God's people. And so this Feast of Purim then, or the Feast of Lots, the celebration of Lots then, is one that becomes a regular feast for the people. And the Jews even keep it today. It's actually in the month of March, or it's coming up quite quickly. And traditionally, what's done, amongst all the different customs they have, gift giving and feasting and all of that, is they come together and they read the book of Esther. Every year, they read through the book of Esther and recite the story. Right. I think it's interesting that we have this. It's different from the feast days that we read about in the law of Moses, because again, God isn't the one who came down and said, you know, on the mount, thou shalt have this feast. This is one that we see, seems that Mordecai and Esther and the people decide that they want to commemorate. So it's different in that way. It's not a commandment from God that they do it, but they do it still. Again, one of the great ironies that we find in this book, and a beautiful story. Beautiful, it's exciting. We see the vindication again of God's people. These were still exiled in a foreign land. And yet, they kept themselves pure. And yet, God took care of them until the very end. It's a great lesson for us, my friends. Because we, as God's people, are exiles. Peter describes us as strangers and as pilgrims. When you become converted to Jesus Christ, it's an eye-opening experience. Paul describes it as a transformation, right, of the body and mind, right? Your whole way of thinking now is different. Your whole outlook on life, who you are, is different, right? Conforming now to the image of his dear son and not conforming to the image of this world. And so it is that when you become a Christian, you find yourself now part of God's family. And you find yourself now a stranger, an exile in the land in which you were raised. Jesus changes us, my friends. suddenly we start to see the truth of the matter and where we really belong. And so, my dear friend, tonight, if this is the night that you realize who you are and where you really belong, and that is in God's kingdom, and you want to change that, and tonight's the night for you to come forward and profess your faith in Jesus Christ, confess Him before this wonderful, loving audience that we have here tonight, be baptized for the remission of your sins. I will tell you, and Brother Darrell can testify to this, the water's cold. But I will get in the water with you. I'll even dunk my head if that's what you need. But it's worth it. It's a small thing. Amen. My dear friend, if tonight is the night you want to become a Christian, know that your future is secure. In such a time as this, why not? Or if you need to be restored, my friend, such a time as this, why not? To let all of us go forward, bolder, encouraged, and knowing we're not left alone. As part of God's people, we're never left alone. Our dear friend, won't you come as we stand and as we sing.